Thank you, Dan, and thank you very much for the invitation to participate in this symposium. I should say, those of you that were here earlier this morning, I'm going to be repeating a lot of what you already heard, because Ratan had emailed me about a week ago and said he wasn't going to be here, or 2 weeks ago, I guess. So some of the information will be repeated, but I should say that my entree into the whole bioenergy area is really focused from a policy perspective, and that's, I'm going to kind of document that as I go through. And so the title is Sustaining the Soil Resource While Moving Towards the Bioenergy Mandate, but I have a subtitle, Something Terrible Happened on the Way to Selling Renewable Bioenergy. And so that's, I think, will give you an idea about where the policy perspective is here. And I think that strong advocates of a bioenergy future came largely from the perception of the non-renewable, or I should say the renewable resource, that is the biomass itself and biomass production, and we're probably less versed in the non-renewable resource, which in fact underpins the production of the biomass, and that is the soil resource. So, the promise of bioenergy, Ratan didn't really speak about many of these promises. He spoke a lot about carbon sequestration and carbon balances. But there, from a policy perspective, we need to consider all of these promises. Energy security is certainly an important one, and it's an important driver in many cases, and particularly in the Bush administration and their very aggressive move into the bioenergy arena. Because in fact, there is a lot of pressure coming out of the Department of Defense right now relative to thinking about energy security issues, and bioenergy fit into the portfolio of a renewable or a non-petroleum-based strategy. Rural economic vitality, of course, this is another very complex piece to this puzzle. I think it's a great promise. Strategies for revitalizing our rural economies through a bio-based future. On the other hand, this also becomes very, very complicated from a policy perspective. As we'll see, for example, some of the definitions of what can be used, what types of lands can be used for biofuel or bioenergy production. Some of you may or may not have read through the EPA's final rule. It's about 236 pages. It's three columns, small print, very boring, but there's a lot of information in there, and I'm still discovering things, and I'll try to point some of those out that I have some important implications. It's not clear to me how they're going to play out, but there's a lot of very interesting information there. Of course, reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, we've heard a lot of that today, and enhanced ecosystem services. The big thing is a rigorous life cycle assessment, and that's very, very difficult to achieve. It's certainly something that the EPA has tried to, or attempted to do with regards to this final rule in terms of the fuel standard too, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Let me say that I believe we can meet a lot of these promises, but I think it has to be in a very calculated way, and I think the trajectory that we are on perhaps is not going to be sustainable. As I think you saw this, and I'm sure many of you are aware of it, but this is something that Ratan, showed. And the big thing, of course, is that we will be leveling off in terms of corn ethanol production at about 15 billion gallons. And this difference that he talked about, the 21 billion gallons, is so-called advanced fuels. Now, of course, again, those of you that follow this realize that last year we had a sea change in terms of what we thought of as advanced fuels. We were thinking about, as Ratan addressed, cellulosic ethanol as being the primary component of these advanced fuels. But last year, of course, the Department of Energy launched a new initiative for advanced fuels that were non-ethanol. And the idea is to move towards biobutanol and other drop-in fuels that would be compatible with our existing infrastructure. And this makes a lot of sense from a number of perspectives. But again, there's a lot of uncertainty with how we get to that point. So again, I think Ratan covered this very well in terms of how significant this increase is going to be and some of the challenges with trying to reach it. And I'll get to some of these figures here in a moment. So just in, this is a USDA estimate in terms of feedstocks and volumes by 2022. This came out of a fairly recent report that was published this past June. Essentially, they were looking at the final rule from EPA and trying to sort out some of the things that they could sort out from the USDA perspective. And you can kind of get this idea here that dedicated energy crops are going to be a big piece of the advanced biofuels. And you can see these other things, oil seeds, crop residues, woody biomass, and of course, the cornstarch ethanol is fixed at the 15 billion gallons. We've heard a lot about crop residues, and I think I'll mention a few words about that as well as we go forward. Again, if you look at the renewable fuels being 20%, this is the life cycle greenhouse gas threshold that is meeting the 2005 baseline in terms of gasoline. So for a renewable fuel, it has to save about 20%. It's really unclear that these renewable fuels do save 20%. In fact, it's most calculations believe that the greenhouse gas emissions are greater from corn ethanol production than from gasoline production. But the advanced biofuels is 50%, bio-based diesel 50%, and then the cellulosic biofuel, which is mandated is 16 billion gallons, is 60%. And so the idea there, of course, is again by the rule. Is to reduce greenhouse gases and mitigate greenhouse gases to a significant extent. So renewable biomass, by definition, stipulates not only the type of biomass, but also the type of lands that can be used to produce that biomass. And I think this has been a surprise to some people, and there was a lot of comment, of course, on the final rule concerning this. But it does state that planted crops and crop residues from agricultural land cleared prior to December 19, 2007, and actively managed or fallow on that date. And this is going to be quite interesting in the southeastern United States, where I'm from, and I'll be focusing a lot on the southeast in terms of looking at some of the qualifiers that they actually state that need to be met to suggest that your land was cleared or in active fallow. Or actively managed. And then, of course, for forest, planted trees and tree residue from plantations cleared prior to December 19, 2007 and actively managed on that date. And, of course, the idea here is that they don't want any movement of any clearing of forests into agricultural lands. So many of you, I'm going to give you a little bit of history of how I got involved in this from a policy perspective, but many of you, of course, are very well aware of this, the so-called billion-ton study, the feasibility of sustainable available biomass. Raton talked about the amount, the 1.3 billion tons or greater that will be required. This report came out in 2005, and at that time, I was on the Committee for Earth Resources at the National Academy, and the Committee for Earth Resources has one token natural resource person, and I was that person. Everyone else is from the oil industry or the coal industry or from the minerals industry. And this individual from DOE came and presented the data from this billion-ton report. And there were some things that just amazed me at the time. One, the statement, the biomass resource potential identified in this report can be produced with relatively modest changes in land use in agriculture and forestry practices, and they, of course, in their calculations, were removing 75% of the crop residues. And so the other thing that was mistakenly picked up from this report was that the conclusion was that there was a sustainable, that the biomass could be sustainably produced to meet this requirement of a billion tons a year. And I would argue that by sustainable, they didn't mean sustainable production. They meant a sustainable supply of biomass. And that's a big difference. And the big question comes in terms of sustainable bioenergy production conundrum, as I like to refer to it. Okay, this report came out by Fales in 2007. And it just, again, shows some of the data that and some of the challenges that Raton spoke to today in terms of the amount of biomass currently being produced and the amount that has to be produced to meet the goals that are set out in the mandate. And these are significant increases, as Raton has suggested, and the amount of land that's been estimated to produce these amounts of biomass are also quite significant. I think we can't really discuss biofuel and bioenergy production without going back and thinking about how it fits into what Tillman, I think, has very aptly termed the food, energy, and environment trilemma, what I call the perfect storm. And that, of course, is that we have these pressures on energy, food, and water, as well as climate change as a forcing factor. And we have this population that is increasing, as Ratan discussed this morning, up towards 9.2 billion people. And we've got this huge challenge for producing food for that many people. And speaking with Tom Friedman before his address on Sunday, one of the things that he mentioned was that how the financial crisis has really diverted our attention from these major global issues. Before that financial crisis, we were getting a lot of attention in terms of the food crisis and the impending food crisis and the water crisis that really is very serious. And now we talk about it as scientists, but from a policy perspective, it's pretty much gone away. And so I think many of you probably know these numbers, that is, more food will be needed to produce to be produced worldwide over the next 50 years than produced in the past 10,000 years. Projected a doubling of global grain demand, doubling of food production will be required. Now, this is an interesting thing because, again, this comes, and I'll talk a little bit about this in a moment, but then you get these reports. This was just published last year by the UN, and their projection was that food production will fall 25% by 2050. And that was just based on soil degradation, the issues that Ratan, I think, addressed so well this morning. And they also, some estimates on climate change and the impact climate change is going to have on food, water stress, invasive pests, and soil degradation. I really like Ken Kassman's assessment. He's got this paper. It's a good paper if you haven't read it. Food and fuel for all, realistic or foolish. And it's quite a telling article. It also reminds me of this quote from Niels Bohr. We are all agreed that your theory is crazy. The question that divides us is whether it is crazy enough to have a chance of being correct. And I think this challenge that we're faced with in terms of food production is quite important. And Ratan actually addressed this morning as well. The arable land per capita is decreasing precipitously, and it'll be just a little bit over a tenth of a hectare by 2050. And again, superimposed on that now, of course, is our goals of producing biomass. This will be the last thing in terms of food production, but I think it holds true as well for biomass production in some of our systems, and that is, we have some optimists in terms of being able to meet this food demand, and of course they have an interest, but the maize yields will double by 2030, and this is going to be based on the advances in genomics, of course, that are going to save us. But this is Ken Kassman's assessment of that. He looks at grain, this is corn grain yields since 1965, as you can see, and what he points out is that there's been tremendous advances, not only through breeding, but also in management of pesticides, integrated pest management, that have led to these really significant increases in yields. But he also suggests, is it realistic to assume that this 1.2% increase can now go to 2.3% to meet the goals that we're going to need? And in fact, all data that he shows for a major for major grains such as rice, for example, are actually decreasing worldwide on a global scale. And so there's a whole thing about this yield potential, which I think is an important thing, and that is that about 80% of the yield potential, and that's really the golden standard in terms of what people have been able to actually achieve on a large-scale basis. And so then even any increases from genetics or genomics are going to have to be accompanied by increases in management to actually meet those goals. So there's a huge challenge, and one is meeting the biofuel feedstock production target, as well as providing additional bioenergy over the next several decades, along with this abruptly shifting global food supply and demand balance. So we'll be going from surplus to deficit. Some people suggest that that'll happen by 2030. Some predict that may even be sooner than that. So the grand challenge is to develop and implement a sustainable production system for bioenergy, but superimposed on that is keeping our food, feed, and fiber systems productive as well. So again, going back to my experience from the policy perspective, from 2005 to present, virtually the entire research portfolio was focused on post-harvest processing, conversion technologies, refining plant qualities, et cetera. And again, I believe this is largely either ignorance that the non-renewable resource, the soil resource, underpins the production of biomass, or it's just a total misunderstanding of how sensitive the soil resource, in fact, is to these management challenges. And again, Rutan kind of ended with that the soil resource is being destroyed globally, not only from agricultural production, but from deforestation as well as desertification, and we have some big problems. This issue of agricultural wastes came up before. It was just amazing to hear these early talks about agricultural waste from the Department of Energy. And we had a meeting by 2006. I was now chair of the U.S. National Committee for Soil Science at the National Academy. We brought in the head of the biomass program at DOE, and we had some USDA people. And Rutan was on the committee, and some of you know Peter Groffman, and we had some people that really understand some of the implications. And they grilled this guy. Well, he was showing maps where he was actually growing dedicated energy crops on federal lands. And then he continued to discuss agricultural waste. And you can imagine, maybe that's why Rutan was in the hospital a couple of weeks ago. But at any rate, it was remarkable, and in fact, as late as early this year, I still heard the term agricultural waste. Although I think most of the engineers that the chemical engineers, the conversion people, have become sensitized to it, but occasionally they do still slip. So we issued a white paper at that time, and this was still, of course, in the previous administration. We were quite concerned in 2007 at that the billion-ton report all of a sudden was taken as a sustainable. That sustainable word was being used in terms of biomass production. At face value, of course, in the State of the Union address, it launched a $500 million program in the DOE for biomass production, while if you recall that year, the NRI budget was slashed by the president's budget, although it was restored by Congress. And so we were in that room, and he pointed to USDA and said, no, they handle the things you're talking about. And of course, USDA was, I think, faced with a 50% cut, proposed cut, in the NRI budget. So this is kind of where we were coming from. In 2008, things changed a bit. We had a transition team. We had a transition team document. We got some very good audiences with OSTP, OMB, USDA. And then, of course, with AFRI. And as we know this year, the AFRI Sustainability Bioenergy Challenge area was launched. You should really be proud of your Soil Science Policy Office, because they had a lot to do with actually getting these things through. And I should say, really incredible testimony to me that we've really gotten through at a policy level is this memo that came out this summer. This is an important memo because the administration, of course, is planning on cutting all agencies 5%. And this is a joint memo by OSTP and OMB that provides guidance to these agencies in terms of what the administration's priorities are. And you can see some things here. And one thing that's interesting as well that you may or may not be aware of, but in addition now to our transportation fuel replacement, the administration has set a goal for replacing 25% electricity from renewables by 2025. And so cogeneration and some other things are now aggressively going forward as well. So we can see that now not only are we looking at this incredible target for transportation fuels, but we're looking at an incredible target for electric generation. And in the Ohio River Valley, where I am in Kentucky, this is a big deal. The coal fire plants are currently doing a lot of research on switchgrass and some other things for co-firing. This is an incredible statement here, because I have to tell you, the first time I met with the OSTP in 2008 and we mentioned soil carbon sequestration, the individual who was very familiar with deep geologic sequestration said, I don't understand that. There seems to be a lot of hazards with even injecting it deep into the geologic formation. How do you inject CO2 in soil safely? That was the misunderstanding of soil carbon sequestration. And so that's where we were 2 years ago, and now look at what this is in this memo. I'm sorry. Develop domestic incentives to reward forest owners, farmers, and ranchers who plant trees, restore grasslands, or undertake farming practices that capture carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. I think this is remarkable. And again, I think you should be proud of your Science Policy Office if you're a Soil Science Society of America member. Okay, so here we go again. I'm going to just, you've heard all of this, so I can go through a lot of this stuff pretty quickly, because as I mentioned, I didn't expect Rutan to actually make a presentation this morning. But carbon, in my estimation, is universal currency, and it's unclear to me how individuals that know anything about ecosystem function would propose 75% removal of residues, agricultural residues, for example, some of the other things that were actually proposed. So these ecosystem services we've heard about and we've seen a lot of data about, and of course biodiversity is an important one as well that was only touched upon briefly. Jane showed this earlier today, and that is this idea that we all know that the carbon decreasing from cultivation and the strategies for increasing carbon over time. What I think is quite interesting is a recently published study of, and the question here was, well, how quickly can you lose that carbon? And this was in Alabama, and actually two different soils, but I just want to focus here on this particular soil, because after 2 years, they lost about 55% of the carbon in the surface horizon. And that's through the profile down to 105 centimeter depth. But I thought that was remarkable in 2 years, and I hadn't seen data that actually tracked it, and it may be out there, but I hadn't seen it. So that just gives you an idea about how quickly it can be lost. And one of the reasons I mentioned that is, again, a very politically contentious issue relative to the types of lands that could be used. So agricultural lands, abandoned lands, pasture land, but it also allowed CRP land. And I think Humberto did a great job summarizing how successful the CRP program has been at restoring ecosystem services and actually providing enhancing ecosystem services. So that is a problem. And I want to point this out as well. Rutan showed this data in a table form. This is that paper in Science that he had referred to, where you look at carbon debt. And I just wanted to point out that this bar here, which shows a 48-year carbon debt, was actually based on CRP land that had been under CRP for 15 years coming out. So it's a 48-year payback in terms of your carbon debt by bringing CRP lands out of production and putting them into biofuel production. Again, we saw this before, the organic carbon removal as a function of Stover. This is Humberto's data. He's an incredibly productive young individual. It's amazing how much data that he's actually generated on these systems. But as he points out, he's getting these large effects that he measures over relatively short time frames. And the question is, you know, what's going to happen over longer time frames? And I think that's an important question that needs to be dealt with. And again, showing physical characteristics that then lead to things like runoff and some other things. One thing that, if you weren't here earlier, I think I'd just like to make the point again, because it's a very important one. There's been a lot of emphasis on how much residue has to remain on the surface to prevent either erosion from wind or water. But more recently, as Jane had pointed out, and she's been involved in this work, they've taken a different view, and that is, how much do we have to keep on the surface to maintain the soil organic carbon? And you can see, if you weren't here earlier, if you were, I know this is quite boring because you saw it twice, I think, but if you weren't here, this is remarkable, because the amount of residue that is required to maintain the soil organic matter is much greater than erosion, either by water or by air, by wind erosion. And this, I think, is really changes the whole way we look at it, because I think we did typically think of erosion rather than carbon storage as an important thing. I just wanted to also point out, Humberto mentioned that there is a lot of benefits from perennial energy, dedicated energy crops, and this is part of the promise. I think we can get there if it's done in a very careful and calculated manner. And these are some data that were published in 2009, looking at various systems over long periods of time. You can see this is with 25% removal, 100% removal. You can see the carbon debt there. Sugarcane's interesting over time. I'm not going to get into that too much. But these perennial crops do, in fact, have a carbon positive effect here in terms of soil carbon. And so I think, as Humberto pointed out, there's some really good possibilities there. I also wanted to mention, and Dan, I don't know what you used in terms of your some of your assumptions here, but this is looking at forest management systems. Since this was S7, I thought I should throw some forestry in here. But these are calculations that Dan Richter did on various North Carolina sites, and the slope, of course, is increasing here, so the amount of erosion increases, and then this is the intensity of the management of these forested systems. So these are measurements of erosion, and so certainly erosion in intensively managed forest systems is an issue, and of course it's an issue that is quite dependent on slope, as you might imagine. But again, this is important in terms of the intensity of the management, since the forest systems will also be managed more intensively. One thing that I thought was quite interesting is this cover article in Bioscience. I'm not sure if any of you saw it last year. It was quite interesting. There was three sites, one in Maine, one in South Carolina, one in Missouri, and they had these different management strategies, control forest, a clear cut with where they removed the woody debris, and then they where they had a partial cut, et cetera. And there's a whole lot of data that was generated in this experiment. They had these figures that went on forever. But this is kind of a compilation of the positive and negative effects. And you can see in the partial cut, the clear cut, and the clear cut removed. And this is on amphibian populations, and they had all kinds of endpoints. But the important thing for the Southeast, where again I'm going to focus some of my comments on, is that, you know, there's a lot of sensitive species of amphibians, sensitive or this type of forest management in terms of biodiversity might be quite important in the future as we look towards again more intensive management of these forested systems. Again, this is something I wanted to point out because we've heard a lot about stover removal or residue removal, and I found this in the final rule. I don't know what page it's on, but it's buried there somewhere. They actually do have some percentages of residue that can be removed, and I don't know if they're going to enforce this in the rule, but it's in the rule where they're suggesting that conventionally tilled agricultural systems that, in fact, residues are not going to be able to be removed. Conservation tillage, 25%, and no-till, 50%. And we'll see, and as Humberto mentioned earlier today, that even 50% in a no-till system might be a little bit tenuous in terms of some of the effects. And again, the Southeast, this is just looking at the land areas, the percentages of the biofuel area, or the biofuel amounts that to meet the mandate. And you see the Southeast ends up being quite an important area for a variety of reasons. It's got, of course, a lot of this abandoned agricultural land and pasture land. It also has a lot of forest land, a lot of forest resources. And this just gives you an idea about what the calculations are showing currently. There's other reasons why the Southeast emerges. One is the life cycle assessment. The food versus fuel argument comes up again because of the availability of these land resources that are not currently used for food production. And this just is agricultural land, about 34 million hectares, and this is forested land, 90 million hectares. And I believe of that 90 million, perhaps about 20% of that is intensively managed, and about 5% is fertilized. And the reason I mention that is because even in these sometimes are called marginal lands, or these agricultural lands that have been abandoned, we're really going to be looking, as Ratan mentioned this morning, at intensification of the management of these systems if we're going to get towards the biomass goals that we're going to need to achieve to meet the mandate, which means there's going to be greater nutrient inputs and management. Am I doing for time? Okay. Anyway, we believe that we'll need to be some breakthroughs here. I just wanted to say a few things about nutrients. This is from, Tom Fox had a nice review a number of years ago on forest systems, and this is just looking at summarizing the effect in forest systems, the effect of parent material. And you can see there, in this case, there's no effect of various rotations, whereas in this other system there was. And there's been a number of studies that have shown depletion of important nutrients in the Southeast forest systems, like calcium. Dan Markowitz had a nice study showing that potassium isn't isn't being depleted, at least in this Piedmont, long-term Piedmont study that Dan Richter has headed up. But again, it's really highly dependent on the soil type and the parent material. Because if you go, this is Dan Markowitz's data, but deep in the profile, he has a lot of weatherable potassium minerals, which are actually providing potassium to those plants. Again, you get down in the coastal plain, and this is a lot more tenuous. Willie Harris demonstrated that potassium was coming from these micaceous inclusions within hydroxyinterlayered vermiculites, and this is a very limited resource. So there's very few weatherable potassium-rich minerals in the coastal plain in the southeast. So some of the comparisons in terms of the nutrient dynamics and the forest systems, I think, need to be qualified in terms of what the specific issues are regarding the soil and even some of the deep extraction of calcium, for example, that Dave Riegel reported, again, is not, that would occur perhaps up in the southern Appalachians, but not so much in the coastal plain. And this is just, again, Dan Richter's data on phosphorus, and I think, Dale, this might be, you might be onto something there, because what Dan has demonstrated with his long-term data, and this is from over 30 years, is that the phosphorus is actually being extracted from the more recalcitrant phases in the soil and being moved towards the more available phases over time. So you're getting a depletion of these very more difficultly available phases, and that therefore being taken up by the trees. And so you may be seeing, Dale, a transfer of phosphorus that would not necessarily be mobile in that forest system, and then it goes up into the biomass as an available form. So your idea about phosphorus perhaps getting into Lake Tahoe is perhaps consistent with this hypothesis. All right, I'm just going to finish up really quickly by suggesting that there are a lot of policy instruments that also need to be thought about, and that is that if we're going to get to and actually meet some of the promises, we're going to have to think about policy instruments that get us there. And I don't know if any of you have read Mark DeLucci's work. He's at UC Davis, but he's done some really interesting studies for many, many years looking at the externalized costs of petroleum-based fuels, but he's also now doing this with biomass. And one of the things I like about his estimates is they seem to be very conservative, but we looked at these numbers in the Committee for Earth Resource, and this 75 to 125 billion, that's actually the costs. Those are the costs associated with keeping oil flowing from the Middle East. And these are very conservative costs. And so if the United States is serious about promoting a bioenergy future, serious about taking care of rural communities and stimulating the economies in rural areas, we really have to think about what the policy instruments are going to be, much like Dale was talking about how difficult it is for fire management. These types of incentives are going to have to be in place, and we certainly have provided them for petroleum-based systems. In fact, there's some recent papers that say that the real cost of a gallon of gasoline is $15, and that might be a high estimate, but it's certainly no less than five, and that's because of these externalized costs that have not been based on, if you look at the tax structure, they had a nice graph in CNE News last year where they said, our incentives, our energy incentives are still very black, not green at all. So if you compare the tax breaks given to oil companies compared to renewable energy companies, they're just not the same. So we're not, we have to, if you're going to look at the true cost of the biofuel and the biomass production, you have to compare it on an equal basis with the petroleum, and I think that's what Mark's major point is. Okay, and I'll finish up with this slide real quick. In terms of a science frontier, I think looking at processes in the rhizosphere, this is something that has come out over the last several years from a number of reports. One was focused on bioenergy. But looking at moving towards sustainable production systems, be it food production or bioenergy systems, we need to look at new models of sustainability and nutrient management. And a lot of it is looking at these rhizosphere processes. And I think what's really nice about these dedicated bioenergy crops, such as switchgrass, is there's been very little development, relatively speaking, in terms of germplasm development. And so thinking about developing germplasm with not only with not only a focus on the above-ground biomass production, but also what's happening below ground. Because what's happened in many of the things, with many of the crops that we're moving to some tropical soils, for example, we've realized we've bred out some very important qualities that are related to nutrient use efficiency, water use efficiency, and also carbon balances below ground. And we certainly don't want to move in that direction now. And I think let's just go down to here. The opportunities to address the energy security issue and move towards a carbon neutral energy source while transforming agriculture and forestry production systems, as well as ensuring the long-term economic health and vitality of rural communities, are immense. But as Dan Richter started the session, we really have to get this right. And I think getting it right means we have to protect the soil resource and think about the non-renewable resources, the soil resource, and ensure that it's protected as we move forward. So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer.
And got till noon, and I bet there's a few questions here. Yes, Mr. Coleman.
Thanks, Dan. Paul, I was interested in your opinion. I know Brett Pan also written on this topic of using the black carbon pyrolysis byproduct
Yeah, I had sorry about blowing through that stuff, but I did have a slide on that. I think that's going to be an important part of developing sustainable systems. That'll be reuse of not only the biochar, but all types of materials that are produced in the conversion technologies and some other things. We're going to have to be recycling on the land in terms of nutrient inputs. And it'll be the same with waste recycling. We're going to have to really look at waste recycling for nutrients, biosolid recycling. That's the only way we're going to get sustainable. Because, again, if we go to rigorous life cycle assessments, you start looking at, particularly for forest systems, the cost of putting nitrogen and phosphorus on forest systems, not only the economic cost, but the carbon cost and the footprint cost, it gets very significant. And then we have the whole nitrous oxide issue as well that I didn't speak to. So getting the greenhouse gas budgets right is a very complicated process, as you know. But I think all of these recycling these components are going to be critical parts of that to get sustainable systems.
For wildland soils, you said in one of your slides that carbon is sort of a master variable or something like that. And for wildland soils that aren't fertilized, I'd argue that nitrogen really is. Because carbon is going to follow nitrogen and nitrogen. So then, and also as a sidebar, I know some of these soil changes, I think the one from Alabama, they have nitrogen.
That's right, yeah.
It looked like in one case, in 2 years, it lost 4,000 kilograms per hectare.
Yeah, so.
How that possibly happened?
So I wasn't calling it the master variable. I said it's a universal currency of ecosystem services. And of course, you can't decouple nitrogen or phosphorus or sulfur, for that matter, from carbon and carbon cycling. But that's a good point. And yeah, I didn't really look at those nitrogen numbers very carefully. So.
Can track the nitrogen in the Walker Branch changes and everything. Sometimes changes that seem to occur seem outlandishly unrealistic. I think there's something we're not catching
with nitrogen. I should also say that rangelands are not available for use in rangeland. Are not available for use in bioenergy systems, according to the rule, the EPA rule.
I have a question for Dale. On your analysis, your economic analysis, did you consider we're already actually installing towards moving towards more these pre-treatments versus landscape wildfire. You know, because you're showing with managed fire the losses that you know you have in those constituents. And which would be highly accurate, you know, much higher if we had a shot fire. Have you thought about how you would put that into your analysis?
Economic analysis?
Yeah.
No, I mean it came out of that. This is about 2 weeks old for her. I've calculated before and didn't calculate repeated prescribed fire as supposedly or repeated fires prior to 1850 or 1910 or prescribed fire as envisioned now is going to burn off massive, massive quantities of hydrogen, more than a single wildfire, just over and over again to burn off that forest floor. And so it seems to me that unless our budgets are really, really off, we're going to end up with a very oligotrophic nitrogen deficient system. Maybe that's what it was before we had fire suppression. I don't know. Because it's the losses are very, very large.
Let me find this question. It's kind of a feedback.
Go ahead. I think that's what Dale was meaning,
yeah.
That between carbon and nitrogen, that carbon's going to follow nitrogen
right.
In these wildland systems often. Yeah, sorry. I had another question about, and so we have six speakers, if you recall any of the other speakers before. Just an open comment, I remember one of the first slides that Ratan showed in his calculations was a 30% energy conversion efficiency. We've talked a lot about biofuel, and we've talked a lot about bioenergy, and there's another third of the energy crisis, and that is thermal energy. And I just wonder when are we going to deal with thermal energy to its full, to the extent that we need to. There are biothermal systems that are a lot higher in energy conversion efficiency than bioelectricity plants on their own, and certainly more than much higher than biofuel systems. And I'm trying to write and recruiting co-authors to write a paper on renaming bioenergy biothermal rather than biofuel or bioelectricity, from the point of view that we're seeing these limits and we're concerned about the applications with which our economic demand is going to create a bioenergy system, and the fact that you can get 2 to 3 times more energy conversion to be applied to thermal systems is, I think, understated. So an energy engineer of 30 years experience, Tom Kasten, says when America decided to separate electrical production from thermal production, it's utter madness. We build standalone plants, whether they're nuclear or coal or biomass plants, out in the middle of nowhere, what is the symbol of a nuclear plant? It's the waste heat tower. So the maximum extent you can drive a energy turbine on its own is at maximum 40%. Nationally, it's 30% that we burn the energy content of a piece of coal is 2/3 wasted in waste heat. But if you value thermal energy, one can direct it into district energy systems like at the University of Idaho and capture nearly all of that energy content of the original fuel. And I think that that strikes a real good chord for our biomass energy resources, given that we have so much and we want to make the most use out of it. It seems like the applications for thermal cooling or heat are are a way that we can make this energy resource much more likely to be nationally significant. I didn't mean to get on a soapbox. I wasn't one of these speakers. But someday or another, we're going to face up to biothermal like many in Europe have, for example. So I invite anybody to contribute to that paper that I'd like to push through. What other comments did we make? Did we have through the morning? I don't know the Torberg paper in Alabama. Do you know that paper, Emily?
It must be Alan Torberg from Arizona.
Yeah, yeah. So what else? I can pull something I do in class. Alan Lucier probably has probably had a comment or two through the morning. I give you the podium.
I was thinking of making a comment on your thermal.
Okay.
Oh, yes. One was that the rise of the megacities like Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Imperatives was to get combustion out of the city so the air would be calm.
You bet.
Yeah. And this led to the large coal fire and other centralized electric plants. And that's been a pretty effective strategy for the megacities. But I agree with you that in some of the smaller, medium-sized locations, there's high efficiency to be gained by combining. I guess the other point I'd make about that would be, you know, our national policy for two decades around biofuels is been to displace petroleum. And there's a lot more opportunity there with liquid fuels than there is with thermal.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Well, I kind of like this thread.
Could you state your name?
Yeah, I'm Dave.
Thank you.
So maybe one of the things that makes sense, given that heat is one of the desirable end products, one of the forms of energy that people want to get out of it. So if it's not economically viable to haul large semi-loads of chipped residues to remote electric power generation facilities, why not just encourage what still goes on in a lot of places, where I'm from, Northern Michigan, where people obtain on their own a lot of their heat energy requirements by burning wood. And it seems like a pretty logical thing that could be encouraged. It's not economically viable. All the stuff in place, just in a more diffuse way.
So there are objections in certain communities and certain inversion periods to particulate loads of local atmospheres. So the public health authorities are in opposition to that without moving ahead with more advanced ways of combusting wood. But there's a tax credit available until the end of the year for individual residential fireplaces that are so-called high efficiency. Yeah, so is Mary Beth still here? All righty. I'm going to call on Knep. What's your comment from the mountains? Yeah.
Well, I didn't expect that. I'll tap right now.
Okay. Yeah, Stephen.
I'll ask a question since she passed. So
she's temporarily passed, you know.
I'm a little confused on the role of marginal lands and how that plays. He has a quote that was the worst thing we could do, but yet when you look at the numbers it plays in there.
I actually disagree with him on that. What I do agree with him on is that the challenge to manage those sustainably is going to be enormous. That doesn't mean anything.
Because there's a lot of land out there that's marginal.
There's an awful lot of land. That's why calculations for the Southeast come up where they do, because that land is there, so you don't have food versus a biofuel issue. And you have to have that land. One of the things in the rural that's in the rural down here to me is a lot of that main land has not been adequately managed in the land. And if you read the rural, I disagree with Rattan on the point. I think, especially if you're thinking about dedicated perennials and some of the benefits that can actually be derived from those perennials, including carbon storage and some other things, I think there's some benefits that can be made.
I think the point Paul made, I think, was almost a very subtle comment, was the idea of biosolids and the integration. One of the things that's interesting when you think of climate change and when you think of, you know, biomass energy, and when I start thinking of like biosolids, they're problems, but when you start developing an integrated system, particularly when you start talking about degraded agricultural land, the limit is nitrogen. The limit on productivity and the limit that in terms of creating enough biomass to make it a viable system is to have the productivity high enough. But you cannot afford to use high-cost conventional nitrogen fertilizers to produce the lowest value product that we will ever produce. It just does not work from a financial standpoint.
Well, it doesn't work from a greenhouse gas.
Well, yeah, it doesn't work for any reason. But now you got a problem with biosolids, which is what do we do with it? But it's the nitrogen source that we need to drive the productivity of the system. And so there's some really interesting, I think, integration of opportunities that we have to address these problems.
Yeah, not the nitrogen fixtures.
Those two,
animal waste as well.
Yeah. I mean, Eastern North Carolina, you know, we've got swine lagoon problems everywhere, and yet we're trying to figure out how to increase productivity in an economical manner. So I think some really innovative work on combining those kind of systems, can take us a long way toward solving at least some of these problems on a regional scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Realistically, if you take a look at biosolids, what percentage of the nitrogen or carbon input on a land area basis is that really going to be? It's pretty darn small. I mean, it's a big problem. It's piling up in your backyard. But if you're really trying to address the issues of nitrogen depleted lands and increase their productivity, it's not going to address very much of it. I agree with Johnson. I think you should use that. Use it as a resource, but you've got to get other things in there too, and I think that should fix yourself.
I mean, again, from a life cycle assessment perspective, biosolids are being generated in urban areas, and we want to release the biomass in rural areas. So anytime you start looking at transportation, you get into issues there quickly.
Well, I'm intrigued by the urban forest that might play a role here, that it's often underutilized and for particular communities, not
a lot of
use. Pardon me?
It's not available for
use. I'd beg to differ. The EPA has ruled it out. Oh, that's a different matter. Next question, please. Go ahead. Darlene.
Water usage to produce a gallon of ethanol versus
One last question? Yeah. Go ahead.
Dennis,
yes.
I have a comment. We went to this bioenergy, probably ag-related, or ag-related in Atlanta a month ago, and the question came up as to if the South was going to be the source for a lot of the woody biomass, how are they going to corral all the landowners into a constant supply? And as you get more urbanization, then you get pushed to more marginal land. So how are you going to meet these renewable resource requirements and needs if you're getting pushed further away from urban centers and your own more marginal land? And you're in specific areas in the South that are going to be dedicated for that kind of thing. So, I mean, nobody had an answer to it, but it was an interesting question to consider as far as, like, how are you going to corral all these people, all these landowners, into supply?